You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at One Crown Office Row.
I am Emma Louise Fenelon from One Crown Office Row Chambers. In a recent High Court decision, YAH and Medway NHS Foundation Trust, Mrs. Justice Whipple addressed the issue of claims brought as a result of psychiatric harm arising out of childbirth and clarified the law on this. Richard Booth QC from One Crown Office Row acted for the successful claimant in the case, and here with me to talk about it is Suzanne Lambert, also from One Crown Office Row. Suzanne, welcome.
Hello.
First, a little about the facts. On the 9th of July 2012, the claimant, YAH, gave birth to a daughter, XAS, who was born with cerebral palsy after a difficult labour. The trust admitted that XAS had suffered injury through negligence, which resulted in delayed delivery despite clear signs of fetal distress. The claim brought by XAS proceeds separately. Her mother brought her own claim for psychiatric injury, suffered as a result of the delivery and subsequent discovery of her daughter's diagnosis. The defendant argued that the claimant was not entitled to claim damages in the circumstances. Mrs. Justice Whipple had a number of issues to decide. The first was whether the claimant was a primary victim. Can you tell us a little bit about what was held?
This is a very interesting case, Emma, because Mrs. Justice Whipple has clarified that mothers in the claimant's position are primary victims who can claim damages for pure psychiatric injury in the absence of any physical injury. So she had to first decide whether the claimant was a primary victim, and she held that she was, in fact, a primary victim. It was particularly interesting because the defendant asserted that the claimant was not a primary victim and made a number of novel arguments. Counsel for the defendant suggested that the effect of the Congenital Disabilities Civil Liability Act 1976, which gives the child a right to sue for damages resulting from negligence before the child's birth, somehow modified the common law position so that where the child survives and can sue independently pursuant to that act, the mother somehow loses her status as the primary victim, or alternatively, that her status is altered at the time of the baby being born so that she is no longer a primary victim and becomes a secondary victim. Mrs. Justice Whipple was not impressed with those arguments, and she held that it was settled law that a baby is a part of its mother until birth. That is, the baby and the mother are a single legal person. And secondly, that the mother is a primary victim insofar as she suffers personal injury consequent on negligence which occurs before the baby is born. Mrs. Justice Whipple made clear that the fact that the baby and the mother may be able to claim damages arising from the same negligent act does not mean that there will be double recovery. And the compensatory principle means that the mother and the baby would be precluded from recovering from the same loss twice, so long as there are separate losses which have been suffered by the mother and the baby, then they are entitled to claim from the same negligent act. And the argument advanced on behalf of the defendant that the 1976 Act deprived the mother of her primary victim status found no favour with Mrs. Justice Whipple.
The defendant also attempted to argue that even if the claimant was a primary victim, in circumstances where there was, the defendant argued, no physical injury and the claimant is claiming for pure psychiatric harm, the claimant could only recover if she fulfilled the Alcock criteria and in particular fulfilled the shock control mechanism. Can you tell us briefly about how the court dealt with the defendant's argument?
Because Mrs. Justice Whipple found that the mother was a primary victim in this case, her claim failed to be determined according to the ordinary rules governing personal injury claims and negligence, and not by reference to the Alcock principles or Alcock control mechanisms, as they are commonly referred to. Mrs. Justice Whipple made clear that as a primary victim, she would not need to establish that her psychiatric injury was caused by shock. Now, Lord Acner in Alcock defined shock as follows. Shock, in the context of this cause of action, involves a sudden appreciation by sight or sound of a horrifying event, which violently agitates the mind. It has yet to include psychiatric illness caused by the accumulation over a period of time of more gradual assaults on the nervous system. Because Mrs. Justice Whipple found that the claimant in this case was a primary victim, it followed that she did not need to satisfy the Alcock criteria. Mrs. Justice Whipple accepted the submissions on behalf of the claimant that the collision scenario in Page and Smith extended to the negligently managed labour in this case. The accident in which Mr. Page was involved in the case of Page and Smith fell a long way short of the sort of shocking event which was envisaged in Alcock. It was a low-impact collision in which no one was hurt. And by allowing the appeal in that case, the House of Lords necessarily accepted that shock, as described in Alcock, was not a necessary component. The claimant submitted that shock, however it is defined, is not a necessary component in law for any ordinary victim claiming damages, whether it's for personal injuries, physical or psychiatric injury, or a combination of both. And Mrs. Justice Whipple agreed that where the claimant is a primary victim, not a secondary victim, there is no difference between pure psychiatric injury claims or claims where psychiatric injury is sustained alongside physical injury or physical injury alone. She referred to the words of Lord Lloyd in Page, where he explained that in an age when medical knowledge is expanding fast and psychiatric knowledge with it, it would not be sensible to commit the law to a distinction between physical and psychiatric injury, which may already seem somewhat artificial and may soon be altogether outmoded. Nothing will be gained by treating them as different kinds of personal injury so as to require the application of different tests in law. So the test should be the same whether or not it's physical injury alongside psychiatric injury or pure psychiatric injury. The term nervous shock, which has traditionally been used to describe these claims, is an outmoded one, and the court seemed keen to move away from that term.
The next issue, that of remoteness and whether the claimant's psychiatric harm was too remote from the defendant's negligence to send in damages, was one that turned ultimately on fact and expert evidence. The claimant's expert indicated that he had found it difficult to fit her symptoms within the guidelines or grid lines of classification. He said that the claimant's early symptoms met diagnostic criteria for anxiety disorder, but were better understood as falling within the constellation of post-traumatic stress symptoms. On the other hand, the defendant's expert diagnosis was one of depression, triggered by the claimant being told of XAS's extensive injuries and the recognition that she would require substantial care, this happening sometime after XAS was born. This was later coupled with a generalised anxiety disorder, which came on when the claimant fell pregnant again several years later. Both experts signed a joint statement, which included the following. We agreed that a number of factors had contributed to YAH having suffered a mental disorder, including the experience of a difficult labour, the worry of knowing whether or not her daughter would survive, and importantly, the strain of looking after a child with significant disability. Suzanne, can you tell us a little about how the court dealt with this particular issue?
The effect of the agreed expert evidence, which you've already outlined, in summary, was that the claimant suffered an anxiety disorder shortly after she had her daughter as a response to her experience during the birth and afterwards. She did suffer depression, which came later, and it was triggered in large part by a recognition of the extent of her brain injury. That damage was more remote, but the conditions combined to form a single, indivisible mental disorder, which, according to the expert evidence, has varied in intensity over time, but a disorder which is ongoing. So the fact that it was a single, indivisible disorder meant that the various causes including the experience at Booth immediately afterwards and subsequently when she discovered the extent of the brain damage, all contributed to that mental disorder, which is a single indivisible injury. The defendant's expert in joint discussions made a number of concessions which led to Mrs. Justice Whipple coming to those conclusions as to the nature of the psychiatric injuries suffered by the claimant. And that created substantial difficulties for the defendant because once it was seen to be a single indivisible mental disorder, which was contributed to materially by the Booth experience and the psychiatric injuries suffered by the claimant during the Booth and immediately afterwards, then as a contributor to the mental disorder, it meant that the claimant would be able to recover for the whole of the psychiatric injury, the mental disorder, which the experts agreed had occurred in her case. It is interesting as well that Mrs. Justice Whipple did not find the defendant's expert to be a helpful witness, in contrast to the claimant's expert, whom she found to be a compelling expert witness in whom she had confidence. She suggested that he had appeared to have thought carefully about the claimant's case. Her comments on the defendant's expert were much less complimentary, and there are perhaps a number of cautionary tales for experts in general to be found in the comments of Mrs. Justice Whipple. One of those was that the instructions provided to the defendant's expert was that this was a claim for nervous shock to a secondary victim. So it essentially prejudiced her views by giving her an instruction which had decided a matter which was actually a matter for the court. So for that reason, her reports focused on the shock or lack of it at the time of the birth, which, in the words of Mrs. Justice Whipple, was the wrong target. And that mistaken approach appeared to have coloured much of her thinking. Mrs. Justice Whipple was also not persuaded that the defendant's expert had a great deal of experience in dealing with patients in a similar position to the claimant. She had been involved professionally in the running of a secure unit which housed psychiatric patients, which of course is not the type of patient we were talking about here in this case. Therefore, their mental health problems were of a completely different type and seriousness from what was an issue in the claim. Additionally, although she had a private practice, it appeared to be a very small part of her overall work historically, and in fact, she now did a lot of medical legal work. As I've already said, she made a number of concessions in the joint statement, particularly regarding the causes of the claimant's psychiatric injury, which allowed Mrs. Justice Whipple to come to the conclusion that there was a single indivisible mental disorder. And in cross-examination and close examination by Mrs. Justice Whipple herself, she did try to roll back rather unsuccessfully from those concessions, such that Mrs. Justice Whipple asked her whether she could take her joint statement as read. And finally, Mrs. Justice Whipple found her to be overly dogmatic about the classification of mental illness, sometimes ignoring the evidence in order to put across her arguments. We all know that experts aren't meant to argue a case. They're there to assist the court as part of their duties. The fact that she also stated openly that her preference was to work for defendants, and the reason she gave to Mrs. Justice Whipple for preferring to work for defendants did not help her cause. So overall, Mrs. Justice Whipple was not impressed by the defendant's expert, did not find it to be helpful, and therefore placed little or no weight on her evidence at court.
Recent trends have tended strongly against recoverability for psychiatric harm involving clinical negligence and or hospital settings, although there have been exceptions. The Court of Appeal most recently dealt with secondary victimhood in Ronayne and Liverpool Women's Hospital NHS Foundation Trust, a case from 2015. That case concerned a claim for psychiatric harm by a husband of a woman who was readmitted to hospital following a negligently performed hysterectomy. During a period of 2 days, he observed a rapid deterioration in his wife's condition, including an episode in which he observed her connected to various drips and monitors, and another the following day when he saw her in a post-operative condition, unconscious, connected to a ventilator, and significantly swollen in her arms, legs and face, resembling what was described in court as the Michelin Man. Lord Justice Tomlinson gave the leading judgment and indicated he regarded as telling the fact that, so far as counsel were aware, there had been only one reported case in which a claimant had succeeded at trial as a result of observing in a hospital setting the consequences of clinical negligence. He found this unsurprising, reasoning, in hospital, one must expect to see patients connected to machines and drips, and to see things that one may not like to see. A visitor to a hospital is necessarily, to a certain degree, conditioned as to what to expect, and in the ordinary way, it is also likely that due warning will be given by medical staff of an impending encounter likely to prove more than ordinarily distressing. Interestingly, in that particular case, the Court of Appeal relied upon the evidence of the same defendant expert as in the case we're discussing. I wonder, in light of the judgment of Mrs. Justice Whipple, are childbirth claims now to be regarded as a category apart, in your opinion?
I think, as I said at the outset, this is an important and interesting judgment. I'm not sure that it would mean an extension of secondary victim claims such that the effect of the Ronayne decision or judgment is eroded. The position for secondary victims will remain very difficult in clinical negligence claims. In the instant appeal, Mrs. Justice Whipple found that the alternative claim of the claimant, if she were to try to establish herself as a secondary victim, would fail. Even though she had experienced traumatic and shocking events in the ordinary sense of those words, they would not constitute shock in an Alcock sense. And that involves the sudden appreciation by sight or sound of a horrifying event which violently agitates the mind. It does not include psychiatric illness caused by the accumulation over a period of time of more gradual assaults on the nervous system. In this case, the claimant was defined as a primary victim and therefore did not have to establish a secondary victim claim. Mrs. Justice Whipple found that she did not satisfy the legal requirements in the Alcock sense of having suffered shock. She did not, in other words, have a sudden appreciation of a horrifying event which violently agitates the mind. Rather, it could be said that her psychiatric illness was caused to some extent or to a large extent by the accumulation over a period of time of more gradual assaults on the nervous system, which is absolutely fine, sufficient for a primary victim, but not for a secondary victim. In my view, this is a judgment which is important, but which can be seen in the context of claimants like YAH who suffer psychiatric injury as a result of negligent events during childbirth.
So as you say, the bar remains very high for secondary victim claimants in the clinical negligence context. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Suzanne. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me, Emma.
LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.